Today in Studio 360...
Worrying can't get you anywhere.
Has any children's entertainment shaped the modern American sensibility more than Mad Magazine?
Excuse me, is this Mad Magazine?
No, it's Mademoiselle. We're buying our sign on the installment plan.
There wouldn't have been National Lampoon without Mad. There wouldn't have been Spy Magazine without Mad. There wouldn't have been The Simpsons without Mad. There wouldn't have been Saturday Night Live without Mad.
From our series on American icons, Mad Magazine, and the invention of comedy as we know it. And we'll hear from one of the great singers of classic country music, although she was born in 1990. That and much more is ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson.
Funny little fella who you all know, he can cheer you up when you're feeling low.
I grew up reading Mad Magazine, and there's a fair chance you did, too. Today on the show, we'll find out why a satire magazine for kids has had such deep and broad and long-lasting influence. But first, one of the most anticipated shows on Broadway this season was called Holler If You Hear Me. It's a musical loosely based on the life of the late 90s rap superstar Tupac Shakur and uses his songs to tell the story of a young man out of prison trying to survive life in the ghetto.
I need a house that's full of love when I need to escape a deadly place that's slinging drugs in Doug's mansion.
Every corner, every city, there's a place where life's a little easy, little Hennessy.
It was talked about as maybe the first big-time hip-hop musical. But reviews weren't great, ticket sales weren't great, and the show closed this week, just a month after it opened. So inevitably, one wonders, is there a place for hip-hop on Broadway? Saul Williams is a poet and actor who played the show's lead, and he's here with me now. Saul, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having me.
So back when the producers of Holler first approached you, what was your reaction? Did you sign up immediately?
I heard about the project before the producers approached me, and I had my initial response was, that's silly. I thought it was biographical.
Uh-huh.
Like many people, I thought it was going to be a biographical.
Biopic on stage, yeah.
Yeah. And so when the producers approached me, of course, they approached me with the script, more information. I read it, and I thought it was a brilliant idea.
What do you think, what do you make of the widespread take in the reviews is that this just recycled the cliches of the last few decades and it didn't bring us anything new in terms of the story.
That is the challenge we faced in Holler If You Hear Me,
right.
Is that I get it before they walked into the door,
right.
Never realizing that they didn't get it. That is the challenge we faced with critics, you know, who were like, oh, I get it. Yeah, gun violence in the black community. Oh, I get it.
Yeah.
As if it's something passe. We wouldn't be repeating the story if it weren't completely still relevant and now, you know? There's 300% more black men in prison than when Tupac was rapping about it. Every single person that walked into the theater was like, oh, wow, this is not what I imagined.
Right.
I saw the people on their feet standing ovations. You know, we performed it over 50 times.
Yeah.
Every night. Every performance, no exceptions.
So you had these audiences in the house who loved it, gave you standing ovations and all that. Why couldn't you get more of them, just on a commercial basis? Why was it hard to get the hip-hop fluent, loving audiences to come to the theater?
There were tons of people who just straight up considered that it would be there whenever they got there, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it's a matter of...
Yeah, I was supposed to see it this week, and
exactly,
it was closed. Yeah.
Exactly. So you have that. You have all the hip-hop radio at first, and all the hip-hop marketing people were upset because the Broadway marketing company that the producers used at first didn't approach them, and they felt kind of offended. Like, why haven't you come to The Source? Why haven't you come to Vibe? Why haven't you come to Hot 97? Why haven't you come to us?
Yeah.
You know? And then the other side is what happened... during the walk-up, you know, the tourists on the streets and what have you, and are choosing between seeing Rocky the Musical, which to me is like, you know, like when my son wants to buy a book that's based on a film, I'm talking, you know, novelization. Like Harry Potter, a novelization of a film. I'm always like, dude, let's find a better book. And the choices that some of the audiences are making on Broadway seem to be, you know.
Right. Although in this case, I mean, that there was a sense of, oh, this is a huge star, icon, amazing guy who sold tens of millions of records. There was an expectation that there was a sort of pre-marketed quality to this.
I'm sure there was, but I mean, he didn't sell those records to Broadway audiences.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying? So
exactly.
they had to do their work in order to pull in a new demographic.
Yep.
All I can really speak to is how powerful the ensemble was.
Yeah.
How much passion came from
the
stage.
Well, and I want to say to our listeners,
yes,
that your performance, the performers, got much better reviews than
more than
the
much
show.
Better reviews. We got rave reviews.
It's true, absolutely. The title of the show comes from the Tupac song "Holler If You Hear Me," and I want to play a little bit of that. That was "Holler If You Hear Me" by Tupac Shakur. Was it hard to turn that into musical theater? Because just in terms of lyrical information per second, there's about twice as much in that hip-hop song and probably in most than in the conventional Broadway musical theater lyric.
The point that we need to be clear on is that hip-hop itself can be aligned, especially when you're dealing with the writing of Tupac and some of the greats in hip-hop, can be aligned with what has happened in some of the Shakespearean sort of writing, what have you, in that there are layers of meaning. And that's exactly what belongs on the stage, because the point of a musical is for the song to push the narrative forward. Hip-hop does that better than your average musical.
For sure. And as much as great as Broadway can be, seldom, however, does Broadway, where you need 1,000 people a night paying $100 or $200 or $300 a night per ticket, do that. I mean, there is this other world of theater off Broadway that does and is mission oriented to doing the kind of thing you're talking about.
Right. But, you know, my role in the game has always been to see some of the periphery art forms be pushed more to the center. You know, like I'm a poet,
sure,
but I'm here standing before you, you know, talking, you know, as opposed to being wrapped in some blanket in my room, crying, writing on, you know, strips of toilet paper.
Yeah.
You know, like it's the goal is really to see the effect in culture that's going to get us thinking, that's going to get us critiquing and analyzing what's happening in society, because it's urgent. Tupac was someone who saw the urgency in what was going on in today's society and chose to speak up about it. It has all of its place in theater, just as he was in theater as a kid doing Raisin in the Sun when he, you know, at the Apollo when he was 12 years old, you know. And when A Raisin in the Sun was on Broadway, what do you think the critique was 50 years ago?
You tell me.
Generic.
Yeah.
You know the story.
This is the Negro story.
Yeah, this is the Negro story, whatever. Da, 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 da.
Yeah.
And then it took us some time for us to go, oh, wait, this is important. And we need to acknowledge it and get over our sense of, oh, been there, done that, what have you, and realize that you had over 15 kids on the stage making a Broadway debut there. Young, black, urban, what have you. For every kid that entered that theater, they looked on stage before the story even started and was like, wow, holy crap, I can do that? I had rappers and beat makers come up to me and go, holy crap, I never imagined that my story could fit in a venue like this. They were dreaming of radio and you know what I'm saying? Never realizing that it actually could go to that level. And that's also why that play was important, is because it upped the game in terms of what the dream can be. For me, as a young theater kid, it means everything.
Saul Williams, it has been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Saul Williams is a poet, musician, actor, and star of the Broadway musical "Holler If You Hear Me." And our entire conversation is online, if you want to listen, at studio360.org.
Here we go, turn it up, let's go. From block to block, we're snatching hearts and Jack and Mark. And the punk police can't pay me.
What do you all think? Will rap and hip-hop ever be a hit on Broadway, and when? Leave us a comment at studio360.org.
I give up everything that you're living. Bless. Much love to my brothers in the pit. See you when I free you. If not, when they shove me in. Once again, it's all that's back.
Keep your hands on your cat.
And your boys watch your back. Cause if they catch you in the alley, I tell you, mess with the best. And the vets gonna help you. Scream if you feel me. See it clearly. Holler if you hear me.
I like writing poetry.
Oh, I love poetry.
Summer days, summer nights are gone.
A couple of weeks ago, for our latest listener challenge, we started soliciting new poems by high school writers on the theme of summer. Here is Samantha from Virginia reading from her poem, Let's.
Let's dance all night. Play hopscotch in the rain as you twirl me. Spinning, spinning, spinning back time forever in a moment. Let's walk to nowhere, a destination secret until we arrive and stay. Spending the days learning all there is about our newfound home, filling the holes in our knowledge with make-believe. Let's stay inside and watch Breaking Bad, neither of us paying much attention, but rather listening to the clockwork of each other's breaths. Let's lie forever under stars during summer's warmth, taking turns reading from Bradbury and Frost, our voices melting into the evening symphony of crickets, cicadas, and curiosity. Let's be together until time falls apart and slips between our fingers, the two of us unafraid to be free. Each day a new chapter, but it's tricky to write when I haven't found you.
So, high schoolers, there is still time to enter our summer poetry challenge. The deadline is August 18th. And you can find out all the information on our website, studio360.org. And speaking of the youth, if you ever wondered why, starting around half a century ago, kids got so snarky and sarcastic, we've got the culprit.
Mad won. Mad is now the dominant culture. Snark is normal now.
The long, weird shadow of Mad Magazine is just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson.
Who said you could go in my office?
We're exploring. But all we found was a large collection of Mad magazines.
It's a gas!
When I was a little kid growing up in Nebraska back in the 1960s, there wasn't much in the way of fresh, funny subversiveness for children to consume. Yeah, Bugs Bunny and Looney Tunes on TV, but those were already decades old. And current magazines for kids, such as Highlights for Children and Boys Life, seem like relics from our parents' childhoods. Then there was Mad Magazine. People say Dr. Spock gave us the first whole generation of spoiled children. If so, Mad turned them into smart alecks on a scale the world had never seen. As part of our series on American icons, we asked Trey Kay to figure out how this odd little New York magazine became such an important institution.
In the 1950s, serious thinkers believed comic books were polluting young minds. People like Frederick Wortham, an influential psychiatrist.
The real question is this: are comic books good or are they not good? If you want to raise a generation that is half stormtroopers and half cannon fodder, with a dash of illiteracy, then comic books are good. In fact, they are perfect.
Wortham called his book about comics Seduction of the Innocent. One of the best seducers was William Gaines, publisher of EC Comics. He was a comic book innovator who was churning out entertaining crime, war, and sci-fi comics, as well as horror comics like Tales from the Crypt, which were inspired by 1940s radio drama. And Gaines started kicking around the idea of making a comic book that would spoof other comic books.
And so he came up with Mad Comics.
That's Maria Reidelbach, author of Completely Mad, a history of the comic book and magazine.
And from the very beginning, it was really wild. He was going places where comics had never gone before.
Mad Comics hit the stands in 1952 with stories about Super Duper Man and Batman.
Not the Batman we know and love from DC Comics. This is a Batman who wants to knock up Wonder Woman and get her in the kitchen barefoot and pregnant. And there she is.
Mad Comics were doing great until the whole comic book industry was called before a United States Senate subcommittee investigating juvenile delinquency back in 1954.
And you think that does the children lots of good to read those things, do you?
I don't think it does them a bit of good, sir, but I don't think it does them a bit of harm either.
That's Bill Gaines at the hearing. But before Congress could make any laws, comic publishers offered to self-regulate by forming the Code of the Comics Association. There would be no more shooting, no kissing, no fun, basically.
He saw the writing on the wall, and what he decided to do was to try to transform his comics into something even more evolved. And what that was a sort of a magazine format, a hybrid format.
See, comic books were being censored, but magazines were not. So instead of colorful pages, Gaines published black and white illustrations on cheap paper. And there was no more artist hand lettering. Now everything would be typeset. The changes didn't work well for horror and crime comics, but they let Mad's original editor, Harvey Kurtzman, broaden his horizons.
Harvey Kurtzman started mining all of American culture at that point. When he was doing Mad Comics, he was mainly focusing on parodying other comics. But when he went into Mad Magazine, he started parodying newspapers, you know, TV shows. TV was new then. Movies, Broadway musicals, you know, anything he could get his hands on.
Mad invented the sensibility we now call snarky. Sociologist Todd Gitlin wrote about Mad in his book, The 60s, Years of Hope, Days of Rage. He said, if consumer culture achieved some of its power by taking itself hyper-seriously, Mad pulled the plug and said, hey, the Lone Ranger, Wonder Bread, TV commercials, even Marlon Brando are ridiculous.
I had this feeling that a lot of the official proclamations, slogans, icons of the moment were fraudulent or stupid, and what was fun and exhilarating about Mad was that it agreed.
There's a funny little fella who you all know. He can cheer you up when you're feeling.
In 1956, Mad's new editor, Al Feldstein, decided they needed a mascot, something as identifiable as Playboy's bunny. He settled on a painting of a gap-toothed, wiseacre boy with the motto, what, me worry?
Worrying can't get you anywhere.
Alfred E. Newman, the face, was something that had been used over and over by different artists throughout the 20th and back into the 19th century until Mad really took him and really made him their centerpiece.
They put Alfred E. Newman on the cover of just about every issue. That devil-may-care grin seemed like an invitation to something naughty.
It was always something I sort of hid. I don't know why.
That's Mark Dropp, who writes for Disney TV. He says Mad had a big influence on his writing.
There was an older kid in the neighborhood who had a tree house, and when he wasn't around to chuck rocks at us, we would sneak up there, you know, and up in his tree house, he had a stack of old Playboys, and inside that stack was the first Mad magazine I ever saw.
Kids were attracted to Mad's subversive counterculture feel, but also to the goofy, violent slapstick of Spy vs. Spy and Don Martin cartoons, and really weird, inventive things like the fold-in.
I'm Al Jaffe, and I've been doing the fold-in for 50 years.
93-year-old Jaffe came up with the fold-in while looking at the glossy, full-color fold-outs in Playboy, National Geographic, and Life.
So I looked at these things, and there was a sort of mark of pretentiousness about it. And, of course, that naturally triggers the opposite point of view if you're working for Mad.
So Jaffe made a funny drawing with a message below, and there were instructions for the reader to fold arrow A to arrow B in order to transform the picture and message. He brought the demo to editor Al Feldstein.
I said, I think this is a funny idea, but you're not going to buy it because it mutilates the magazine. He looked at it, and he was intrigued. He grabbed it, he says, let me go. And he rushed into Bill Gaines and came out 2 minutes later and said, "We're going to do it." Bill said, "If they mutilate the magazine, they'll buy another one to save."
Another example of Mad's new visual comedy was The Marginal Thinking Department by artist Sergio Aragonés.
Which are these tiny, scratchy little drawings just embedded in the margins and little gutters of the magazine.
Mad fan George Babiak would pore over each issue with a fine-tooth comb.
Each little cartoon was microscopic. It was like taking the magazine down to its molecular level and finding the jokes that made up the whole magazine, the little atomic-sized jokes.
That's an interesting thing about Mad. It was funny, but it was kind of an education. They talk about stupid TV shows and then global politics. In 1963, they did a Cold War parody called When You're a Red.
When you're a red, all the way from your first party purge to your last power play.
When you're it featured red, drawings of Nikita Khrushchev dancing around with a street gang. That's George Babiak singing.
You set off a test, and when you're halfway through it, you point to the west and say they drove you to it. That's how you do it. When you're a red and some land you invade, always say your attack's just a new kind of aid. Then they'll be red, or else they're dead.
I'm Arnie Kogan. I'm a comedy writer. I've been writing for Mad Magazine since 1959.
Kogan also wrote gags for Jackie Gleason, Johnny Carson, and Carol Burnett. He still writes a lot of Mad's movie parodies.
I never aimed anything at kids. I just wrote what I thought was funny. And if kids got it, they got it. If they didn't get it, that was their problem. Or they would learn to get it, or they'd look it up.
It was like a secret window into the adult world. I mean, how many 12-year-olds had seen Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
In fact, he was sort of a flop. A great, big, fat flop.
Stop it, Mother.
I hope that was an empty bottle, George. You can't afford to waste good liquor. Not on your salary, not on an associate professor's salary.
Here's the Mad version.
Well, here we are. Me, the dirty, rotten daughter of a university president, and you, a dirty, rotten history teacher. It's 2 o'clock in the morning, and we've just returned from our faculty party to our dirty, rotten home.
If you recognize the voice, that's Brooke Gladstone from On the Media with her co-host, Bob Garfield.
Right. And now we're going to play dirty, rotten games for the rest of the night. Because through these games, the author plans to dramatically strip away our facades and reveal the fulsome phantasmagoria of base rot that permeates our souls.
That sounds deep. What in hell does it mean?
It means that this is an art film, so now the censors will have to let us talk dirty.
I knew there were strange things going on in my own dysfunctional family that I really didn't understand and that were really disturbing and weird.
That's Maria Reidelbach, the Mad historian.
And when I read the parody of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, I could see that. Even though it was like this warped funhouse mirror version of Edward Albee's funhouse mirror version of this couple, it spoke to me.
The late Roger Ebert said stuff like that taught him how to be a film critic. He wrote, "Mad's parodies made me aware of the machine inside the skin, of the way a movie might look original on the outside, while inside, it was just recycling the same old dumb formulas." And even now, the jokes don't talk down to kids.
I think it's really funny. The things in here, they're just so, they're classic stupid humor. It's hilarious.
11-year-old Liam Schmidt's dad just gave him his first issue of Mad.
And I open it, I start reading it. Oh, this is really funny. The real reasons Vladimir Putin hates America. And I read all of them, and then I saw this one, and it's so funny. He can see Sarah Palin from his house because it's just...
There's a drawing of a goofy-looking Palin standing outside Putin's window.
She's like, "Hello!" It's really funny. It's just Hilarious.
9-year-old Elizabeth Aldous didn't get the Palin joke, but she definitely got the parody of Pharrell Williams' Happy. The mad version is Appy.
Because I'm Appy, I'm on Facebook, Twitter, Skype. I'm even on my space.
It's about some poor soul addicted to his smartphone.
Because I'm Appy, living in an alleyway, sleeping on a pile of trash. Because I'm Appy, got my phone turned back on by selling my blood for cash. Because I'm Appy,
a couple of generations of adults have now been reared on Mad. If you go to the writer's room of a show like The Simpsons, all Mad fans. Al Jean is that show's executive producer.
Well, there's things that we do that are just like Mad, you know, movie parodies, song parodies. The, you know, sort of wise guy sensibility. I think too, you know, like Mad, we try to reach for an audience where kids are a given, but we go for adults.
He says that like Mad packed every inch of the page with jokes. A Simpsons episode was packed so full, fans needed to freeze the frames.
Pause, we knew people had VCRs that they could pause, and we would put things in that you could never catch on a first viewing at regular speed, but you could pause and read if you wanted to, and rewarded people for doing it.
Mad Magazine! Oh.
The writers paid homage in this episode when Bart is visiting New York.
Excuse me, is this Mad Magazine?
No, it's Mademoiselle. We're buying our sign on the installment plan.
Seriously, though, my name is Bart Simpson. My father has a subscription. I'd like the grand tour, please.
Listen, kid, you probably think lots of crazy stuff goes on in there, but this is just a place of business.
Oh, okay.
A dejected Bart turns to leave. Suddenly, a door opens, and Mad's mascot, Alfred E. Newman, pokes his head out.
Give me Kaputnik and Phone Bow. I want to see their drawings for the new kids on the block.
Behind Alfred, the inner sanctum is a fantasy funhouse. People bouncing around on pogo sticks, zeppelins flying through the air, the spy versus spy guys detonating bombs. Bart's jaw drops.
Wow. I will never wash these eyes again.
Well, I think as a kid, you would imagine if you went to Mad Magazine, it would be like the equivalent of a comedy Disneyland.
But if you actually went there as a kid?
My name is Jake Hogan. I'm a comedy writer for movies and television, and I've been getting laid because my dad writes for Mad since I was in fifth grade.
Jay was one of the original writers for The Simpsons. His dad is Arnie Hogan, who writes Mad movie parodies.
And I used to tell my story of going to Mad Magazine with my dad to the Simpson writers, and it was like the most boring, unhappy place. Quiet secretaries, typing, waiting for lunch. Could have been any accounting firm, and it was.
It was not quite as much fun as an accounting firm.
Deloitte & Touche has better parties.
But whether or not the office is an exciting place to hang out, Mad's current editor, John Ficarra, believes there's no denying the impact that the magazine has had on the comedy world.
There wouldn't have been National Lampoon without Mad. There wouldn't have been Spy Magazine without Mad. There wouldn't have been The Simpsons without Mad. There wouldn't have been Saturday Night Live without Mad.
And the Airplane movies, and David Letterman, who was a finalist in their Alfred E. Newman lookalike contest, South Park, The Daily Show, The Colbert Report, and even one not so humorous, but very popular TV drama.
Good morning. Sterling Cooper Draper Price, how may I help you?
Matthew Weiner, creator of Mad Men, says Mad's complete contempt for advertising was part of his inspiration for the TV show. The magazine gave him his first picture of, quote, this drunken, callow, glib, self-serving ad man.
The ad man must catch the 802.
This is Mad's Madison Avenue Primer, read by former editor Nick Meglin.
All ad men must catch the 802. It's a fast commuter train. It has never been more than 2 hours late, but it has a club bar. All aboard, says the conductor. Chug, chug, says the train. Gulp, gulp, says the ad man. Would you like bourbon for breakfast, too?
When Matthew Weiner came to write Mad Men, with its boozy, smoky, sexist, racist characters, he had a message about that era. But Nick Meglin says Mad never had an agenda.
We've always considered ourselves just a funhouse mirror reflection on the society at the time. We kicked whatever politician was in office at the time, not a particular party. We just, you know, if you want to be president, fine. You're going to take whatever fund that we can throw at you. And, you know, you make yourself the target and we have the bow and arrows of humor.
In 1955, when Mad began, it was just one bow, shooting arrows at powerful, huge targets. It reached its high watermark of 2 million in sales in 1974 when it reflected the nation's cynicism over Vietnam and Watergate. But now, there's a 24/7 comedy media that reveres nothing, fires constantly, and never runs out of arrows.
Mad won. I mean, Mad is now the dominant culture. The culture is now a culture of snark. Snark is normal now.
Sociologist Todd Gitlin of Columbia University.
Today, in general, being unserious is the premium posture. I think we have a culture of disposable humor and not a culture that stops anybody in their tracks and says, this is all bloody awful. Gags are what we do here. Taking something too seriously is considered not getting it. And the worst thing in the world is not to get it.
And even a comedy writer like Jay Kogan sometimes wonders, is there a downside to Mad's takeover of American culture?
It supports the idea that it's better to be cynical and examine something than really feel something. And over time, I've felt that I've been much more ready to pick something apart and to make fun of it rather than to just enjoy it for the truth or the fun that it is. I don't think until I actually had a child was I able to really appreciate that there is such a thing as innocent joy. And innocent joy is a pretty good thing. And that's not the kind of thing that we're, you know, extolling in Mad Magazine or almost anywhere else on the spectrum of comedy. There's something to be said for sincerity.
For Studio 360, I'm Trey Kay.
One of Mad Magazine's longest-serving writers is Dick DiBartolo. He's come up with thousands of the magazine's ideas and jokes over the last half century, and David Kippen went to find out what's driven him all these years.
You know you're a class clown when your biggest ambition in life is to write for Mad.
Well, I started out back in high school. I was reading Mad, and after about three issues, I thought, I don't want to read this. I want to write this. So I wrote a takeoff on some ads, and I sent it to Mad. And 6 weeks later, I got back my own big envelope, and I was so depressed. So I opened the envelope, and the envelope, it was just stuffed with cardboard. And on the cardboard, it said, ha, 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 thought this was your script being returned. We have bought your script. Stapled to this cardboard is a check for $100. And please call us because we'd like you to write more for us.
Who knew Dick DiBartolo would still be at it 45 years later?
At first, it was just on and off, on and off. And then Bill Gaines, William M. Gaines, the publisher back then, said, well, what do you want from us? And I said, I just want to be in every issue. And he said, you got it.
He's written for almost all the regular features at Mad. He's brainstormed everything from the Alfred E. Newman covers to the fold-in at the back. He practically invented what's come down to us as the Mad movie parody.
I have a letter in the bathroom from George Lucas saying there should be an Academy Award for satire for their takeoff on Star Wars, which we called Star Bores. But it's one of my favorite things. That's why it's hanging in the bathroom. I was born in Brooklyn. I always wanted to be in show business. I was so stupid as a kid. I would buy the New York Times and I would look under M to see if there were any openings for MCs. And I bought a microphone and I bought a recorder and I had R.D. Bartolo Studios printed on the wall and I would broadcast to the lady next door. Oh, my father hated what I... My father... What do you want to be in life? I want to be a writer. A writer is not an occupation. An occupation involves tools. He said, you know, what is that writing stuff? What do you hang out with people who just drink all day? It was. Yeah.
Did you?
My father was. I wish. My father was born in Italy. Mm. So showbiz was not a big thing in his life.
Why do you think it became a big thing in your life?
To escape my father, to escape my crappy childhood. I did do some therapy, and the analyst said, you probably developed a great sense of humor to overcome depression. So it served me well.
He got out of Brooklyn all the way to Manhattan, where he lives with his longtime partner, Dennis. Mad Magazine's demographic of primarily pre-adolescent boys, not known for their enlightened attitudes towards sexuality. But the offices were okay.
Gay at Mad, it really hasn't played any part in it. I think they used the word faggot in one of the very, very early Mads. And had I been aboard then, I probably would have said, you know, this is really terrible.
Were you out from day one?
At Mad, no. No, you know what? I never hid anything. You would just know because I would say to Bill, have a great weekend, say hi to Annie. And Bill would say, have a great weekend, say hi to Dennis. One day we were going on, Bill had arranged this very special event. And I said, can I bring Dennis? And Bill said, bring Dennis? I'd rather have Dennis come than you come.
In between Mad features, Dickie D helped create Match Game, the risque quiz show from the old Mark Goodson, Bill Todman daytime TV empire. He spent years there writing double entendres for celebrities like Charles Nelson Reilly. Lots of people know Dickie D nowadays as the Giz Whiz. That's his weekly podcast about gizmos and gadgets.
It's time for the Giz Whiz with Mad's maddest writer, Dick DiBartolo.
It's the same dumb show with Dickie D.
He records the show from a home studio that's soundproof, sunlight-proof, and pretty much adulthood-proof.
I call it Gizneyland. So I have the train telephone. When it rings, you hear steam and train whistles. I have many microphones, many cameras, and I can broadcast to tens of thousands of people around the world.
He may be keeping adulthood at bay, but Dickie D is getting old. Bill Gaines, the founder of Mad, died in 1992, and Dick still venerates the memory of the guy who sent him that first $100.
He has a stone in the Botanical Gardens in Brooklyn.
Well, you're from Brooklyn. Are you going to get your plaque?
I doubt it. I mean, Bill's famous. I mean, like, I'm a writer.
So if you had a tombstone, what would it say?
I guess what me worry, I don't know. No more what me worry. I worry no more.
What me worry, I never do.
For Studio 360, I'm David Kippen.
I'm always amused and amusing you.
We've got some of the classics from Mad's archive up on our website, such as the Cold War parody East Side Story and the cover of their first issue. While you're there, if you have memories of Mad Magazine, we'd love to have you share them in our comments section.
What me worry, I never do.
Still ahead this hour, a country singer who sounds older than her years. Way older. Lydia Loveless performs live right here in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. You're listening to Studio 360, and this is Kurt Anderson.
I haven't felt this way in so long.
Lydia Loveless grew up on a farm in the middle of Ohio where she actually baled hay and fed cattle. Then, as a teenager, played in a band with her dad and sisters. Then got discovered by a big city music producer and made her first album at 17, which all sounds like a standard country music success backstory, except no. Lydia Loveless took a bit of a left turn toward punkier rock and roll, still definitely country-ish, but leaving the banjo and fiddle behind now with her new album called Somewhere Else. Lydia Loveless is here with me now. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
I'd love it if we could start with a song before we talk.
Yeah.
Maybe Everything's Gone.
I'll do that one first, yeah.
Cool.
By the time I get the money, it'll be
That was Lydia Lovelace performing Everything's Gone all by herself on acoustic guitar. That's beautiful and a significantly different rendition than is on this record.
You think?
Yeah. I mean, all and sadder. So that's not a that's not a fictional story, right?
No.
Talk about the real story that that's about.
That's the problem with that song is I guess it's so much easier for me to write these sort of tragic love songs that I'm not afraid to talk about, but my personal history, I guess, is a little more scary territory.
Well, we'll get into both.
But yeah, I mean, it's about my family for one reason or another losing our home, and it was probably the hardest thing I ever went through.
Did it take a while to be able to sort of digest that as a song after it had happened? Or
yeah. It was, I think, one of the first ones I wrote for somewhere else, and I wrote it and then kind of didn't think about it for, like, months because I just didn't want to or play it for anyone.
Uh-huh.
And I was playing with the band, and we had drums on it, and I think I probably started crying and threw a fit, as I am wont to do. And that's why it ended up being so stripped down, because it just – I didn't really want it to be touched, I guess.
Uh-huh.
So we just did something very simple.
So really, the first time you played it with your band, mm-hmm. you started sobbing, basically?
Yeah.
And now you laugh.
Yes. Well, you have to, I guess.
I'm assuming Loveless is not your family name. How did you come up with the name Lydia Loveless?
I guess, I don't know. I like alliteration. And it's like Billy Idol said, he said, making your own name. Well, he said, I gave me my own name, just like everyone else, which the interviewer thought was funny. But he also said, it's not about forgetting your past, but about changing your future. So I guess I just wanted to make a name that would give me kind of a personality.
On your last album, Indestructible Machine, you had lyrics about your social anxiety and difficulty mm-hmm. relating to people. You don't seem so socially anxious or difficult.
I've been hearing that from my therapist.
Really?
He says I seem more relaxed, so I don't know.
Maybe you're cured!
Yeah, I'm better.
Well, I mean, maybe...
A Christmas miracle.
No, and an angel got his wings. Maybe, though, it's just turning 23 and not being an adolescent anymore?
I think I just care less than I used to. People say, you know, no one's laughing at you. Well, the truth is everyone is laughing at you. I laugh at all kinds of people that I see doing stupid things. So I think that's what's helped me is realizing that everyone is laughing at you and there's nothing you can do about it.
Right.
So.
This anxiety thing that you've now cured yourself of, did that make it hard to, like, get up and be a performer? Or
it is really hard. Yeah. But some nights are easier than others. I don't know. Sometimes I just feel better. Sometimes I want to vomit and cry and not talk to anyone or get on stage. But some nights I feel really powerful. So
you've made three albums.
Mm-hmm.
This is your third. And there's been a clear evolution from them, from this sort of straight ahead, like, this girl is a Nashville natural, mm-hmm. to this kind of hillbilly punk, to this more complicated, moody record, mm-hmm. it seems. Do you feel at 23 that you've found your comfortable destination in terms of your mode, your genre?
Sadly, no.
No?
I think that's why I made this album is I guess I have. I know what I want to do. I know I don't want to really push the heavy country thing anymore, but that's always going to be a part of me. But I think I'm just reaching my sort of mental breakdown, early 20s thing. So I don't know what's going to happen next. But I don't think it'll be that different.
Yeah. You won't suddenly be an electronica disco person.
Well, I might have that side project, but yeah.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, thank you.
Lydia Lovelace's new album is called Somewhere Else. But before I let you go, now, you've covered songs by Katy Perry and Elvis Costello and one by Kesha, a great version of her song Blind.
Yeah.
Will you play that as we go out?
Yes.
Thank you.
Tired.
That's Lydia Lovelace playing blind, and you can watch a video of her performance at studio360.org. I'm afraid that's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening. And don't forget, our poetry contest is open. We're accepting entries for a couple more weeks. If you're a high school poet or know one, send them our way. Deadline is August 18th. Studio 360's production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisvaram,
Alana Harper,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Shruti Penamaneni,
Jill Duboff,
Ariel Roland Waring,
Marshall Bright,
Hannah Alonji.
Special thanks this week to Chase Colpin for engineering and Carl Reel for his piano playing. And thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Almost nothing in the music business says success like a Weird Al parody.
It's sort of a signal that an artist has reached a certain plateau in their career. You know, if you've got the Grammys, they've got the platinum albums, then they get the Weird Al parody. So it's just part of the triumvirate there.
Weird Al Yankovic is my guest next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.